It is, it's moot. I keep my restaurant peanut-free. Some of my best customers have kids with the allergy, and it's a food I'm happy to cook without anyway. Almonds are almost always better, and cashews, too. Already done. What else? Gluten? Dairy? No, that's it, just peanuts. She's very low maintenance. I frown. Granted, I'm in a mood, but I dislike that description for women. I feel like we're being praised for trying to make ourselves inconsequential or something. Plus, Annette was actually pretty high maintenance in the traditional sense. She was the reason I learned to bake gluten-free. She preferred organic wines when she drank. And if I used Romano instead of Grana Padano in my pesto, she could taste the difference. If you wanted to meet up with her for a fitness class and then go to lunch together after, you'd have to wait half an hour in between for her to freshen up, a process that involved a straightening iron and an eyelash curler. Having rolled with that for all these years, I'm not sure Charlie really needs or wants a low-maintenance woman. But I don't say any of that. I smile into the phone again, a fake smile, and say, "What's this girl's name again?" "Emily. She's the same age as you, so maybe she counts as a woman?" "Right. It's just the last time you dated, I still thought of myself as a girl. Annette was a girl back then." We were two girls, living next door to each other in a half-decent apartment building, sharing an old Volvo. We were getting ready for our grand plans to start falling into place, piece by piece. It feels so long ago now. "Anyway," I say, breaking out of the reverie, "I can't wait to meet her, this Emily woman." "I know you're lying," he replies, "but that's okay. I always dread meeting your latest conquests, too. Who is it going to be tonight?" I pause. I wasn't going to invite anyone tonight. It seemed like it might be too fraught. But if Charlie's bringing someone... "You'll just have to wait and see," I say. "And just so you know, he's special, too." Charlie laughs at this. "I'll bet. I'll bet he's a real prince." Chapter 5. He is a guy I've been on 3 dates with over as many months, who likes me more than I like him. His name is Dane, and he is indeed shaped like a Viking, tall, blue-eyed, strapping. He's a little too excited when I call him and ask if he wants to join us for dinner, and I think of canceling altogether. But Dane says, "You have no idea how welcome this invite is. I was up north with my family for the holiday until everyone but me got food poisoning from a dubious fish fry last night. I had to get out of there before I lost control of my own gag reflex." Okay, then, there you go. Dane is coming over. "Great," I tell him. I mean, not great on the barfing, great on the you being here to join us. I fill him in on the particulars, warn him Charlie is recently widowed so he doesn't accidentally trigger the waterworks, and advise him not to bring salad or anything, really, because of Keiko's famous morning sickness. He takes it all gamely and says, "No matter what you say, I'm not coming empty-handed. It just goes against every bone in my body." And the line is just the perfect mix of chivalry and double entendre to tickle my fancy. I tell him to surprise me. He does surprise me, very pleasantly, by showing up first of everyone with a very nice bottle of champagne in tow. I love opening champagne bottles. That pop just means something wonderful is happening or is about to happen. And pour him a glass. We toast. "What are we drinking to?" he asks. I tell him, "New beginnings, but to be clear, I am thinking of Keiko's baby." But then, as though I've mistakenly conjured her, a stranger walks in my kitchen door with a pair of long golden baguettes poking out of a kitchen towel. I take in her unusual appearance. Yellow sleeveless sundress in November. Long dishwater blonde tangles in a big tortoise hair clip. Not a drop of makeup, and on her feet, those floral brocade slip-ons that sell 2 pairs for $15 at my favorite Asian grocery. This is who my brother has chosen to replace Annette? "Hello, hello, hi," she says, and she bumbles the bread to give me a sturdy handshake. Her wrists clink with at least 12 bangles. "I'm Emily Hall. Well, actually, I'm thinking about being Emily Davis now, but I can't decide which last name makes the most sense, and it seems more convenient if you have a kid to have the same last name, you know? I stare at her in horror while the word kid seems to light up in neon in the space between us. Where is that brother of yours? She looks around. Don't tell me I beat Charlie here, she goes on. She peers into the dining room, then back out. Nope, not out there. Sheesh, I should have guessed. Is your brother kind of a preener? I mean, don't tell him I asked, but whenever I see him, he's so... just so tidy, you know? With his pressed shirts and perfectly trimmed beard. At first, I worried that he was gay, which is such a tired stereotype. I'm sorry I even mentioned it, but he's not gay, definitely not. I mean... She drops her bread on the counter next to me. Oh my God, you're his sister. I'm so sorry. I'm exhausted. My littlest isn't sleeping well, and I'm studying for nursing school instead of sleeping anyway. Let me try again. She unloads a grocery tote, a big purse, and a Pokemon backpack from her shoulders. All the while, I think on the word. Littlest. Then she sticks out her arms again, only this time to hug. So, you must be Sophie. Charlie has told me so much about you. As you've heard already, I'm Emily, and these are my boys. She turns behind her, then back to me. Where are my boys? She asks, and before I can say anything, she leaves the kitchen out the door she came in, calling, Jeremy, Justin. And somehow the fact that she gave both her sons J names is the thing that snaps me back into the moment. Jeremy, I say to Dane, because he is the only person in the room now. He'll have to serve. Justin? How many more do you think there are? Jennifer? Janelle? Jason? Dane shrugs.
I'd say at least 6 or 7, going off the size of her purse. Is this your brother's new girlfriend?
I guess so. Though my brother didn't speak a word about her having children. Do you think he even knows about them?
Dane laughs. I hope so.
I am considering the possibility of my brother being seduced by someone without ever learning she has children. It seems unlikely. Children come with a lot of ephemera. But how many dates did he say they went on? 2? Maybe they didn't go back to her place. Maybe they had sex in his car.
I grimace. Charlie has a green 80s MG convertible with only 40,000 miles on it. He really, really loves that car. The one time Annette tried to seduce him in it, he had her put a towel down first.
I try to imagine Charlie letting children into the back seat of the MG, and then remember that car doesn't even have a back seat. He's going to be devastated if he pinned his hopes on this woman to get him out of his funk. Poor Charlie. He steps out for the first time since being widowed and ends up with this. I think for a second about just sending Emily away, telling her the meal has been canceled or something, that I didn't cook a bite. But the delicious wafts of sage dressing and corn souffle speak for themselves. So when she comes back in with 2 boys, a teenager so tall and gangly he runs into the HVAC on the way in, and a much smaller young boy wearing light-up roller skate shoes, I say, well, hello there. Now, Emily says, we're all present and accounted for. Boys, meet Sophie and, she gestures to the Viking in the corner. Dane, I supply. A friend of mine from... I take a beat. How did I meet Dane again? I know we met months ago, but only dated a few times.
We met at that thing, remember? Dane says with a wink, and I remember now.
That thing called a dating app. Oh, yes, the podiatry support group I hosted at the restaurant. I remember now. I point to him in stage whisper, bunions. Emily looks between us, mystified. Well then, nice to meet you, Dane. I hope your feet are feeling better. This is my oldest, Jeremy, she says, gesturing to the older kid. Beneath a flat-brimmed Cubs hat, he cuts his eyes over to me as though it is the hardest thing he'll do all day and says,
hey.
I nod in his direction. More than that might come off to him as an act of aggression. And this is Justin? The littler boy clings to his mom and asks me, can I touch that knife? And I quickly say, no.
An awkward silence falls over us. Emily smiles and steers the children away from me.
I packed your backpack with stuff to do, Smooshy darling. And Jeremy, I got you the Sandman prequel you told me about. It's in there.
Sweet, says Jeremy, his voice lower than I expected. He grabs the Pokemon pack off my counter. Come on, Smoosh, he says, and takes hold of his younger brother by his polo shirt collar, walking into my dining room like they own the place. Smoosh? I ask Emily. But before she can answer me, the door opens again. It's Pete, holding a diaper bag and snarling.
Whose ancient Subaru is parked in Charlie's spot?
Oh, cries Emily. That's my car. I know it's old, but it runs like a dream. So good in the snow. I've had it since before Justin was born, and I'm hoping to get a new one soon so I can give this one to Jeremy when he's ready to drive. Not that I could afford it, not the way things are now. If I could just get one lousy child support payment out of their dad. But anyway, should I move it?
She looks at me for an answer as I sort through her last monologue for the actionable information. There's only 3 off-street spots, I tell her at last. One for me, one for Pete and Keiko, and one for Charlie and... I stop myself before I say Annette. Pete shakes his head at me.
Nah, don't worry. I'll park on the street. No problemo.
Maybe Charlie should have to, I say with an arched eyebrow to Pete.
Why?
He asks.
I realize he has no idea who Emily is. Just then, the door opens. Keiko with Nettie balanced on her hip like a pro, which I suppose she is now. I can't believe Nettie is already 1.5 years old.
Oh, it's Nettie! I holler and rush up to her, scoop her out of her mother's arms, and begin to plant kisses all over her like I always do.
She laughs and coos until she suddenly spots Emily and says,
Who that?
And then hides her face in my shoulder. I wish I were the toddler in this scenario. Who dat indeed? Why is there an improperly dressed and verbally spastic woman in my kitchen? Why, for that matter, is there a strapping Viking who seems to be unwrapping a bouquet of sunflowers over by the dish station? Why are there 2 boy children I've never met before in my dining room, and what exactly are they doing in there unsupervised? These all seem like reasonable questions. Instead of asking them, I take Keiko in for a hug around Nettie and whisper so she and Pete can both hear.
Dat belongs to Charlie.
When Keiko pulls back from her hug, her eyebrows are sky high. She introduces herself to Dane and Emily. And, I add meaningfully, Emily's 2 sons, Justin and Jeremy, are already in the dining room. Pete's jaw drops so far I could do a cornucopia display in his mouth for the centerpiece. Keiko says,
Sons?
It kicks off another run of the new woman's babbling.
I'm so sorry about surprising everyone with the boys, she says. To be honest, I had no intention of bringing them anywhere near my love life, not for a long time, but best laid plans, right? They were supposed to spend Thanksgiving with their dad, but... Oh, I don't want to go into it. It'll just make me angry. I was going to cancel on this dinner when I realized their dad wasn't showing up, but when Charlie invited me here, he swore we could just be super casual and act like we were new friends, nothing bigger than that, and...
She pauses, adjusts something on her dress.
I mean, you understand how it is, with the constant pressure to do right by your family, and then at the same time, just the sense that a chance to meet new friends isn't one to pass up either, not at this stage in life, you know?
I literally have no idea what she's talking about, but Keiko, bless her heart, says,
Oh, of course, it's impossible to meet anyone unless a playdate is involved. Everything we do is scheduled now, and I, for one, am glad there are other kids here. That way, if Nettie goes ballistic, and she probably will since she skipped her nap, I won't be the only mother in the room.
Emily gives Keiko a grateful smile, and I will myself to try a bit harder.
Thank you, she says. And I promise you, there's nothing your daughter can do that I won't have dealt with myself between those 2 terrors. I mean, Smoosh alone, he's a walking disaster.
She turns to me.
You heard him ask for that knife. The first thing out of his mouth, a huge chef's knife like that. My God, if we go 2 months without a trip to the ER, I call it a win.
I blink at her.
Having no children, I can't compare parenting skills, but it seems like children should not go to the emergency room every 2 months. But Pete, having finally lifted his jaw off the floor, just says,
Preach, sister. Only one kid so far, and we've been in 3 times this year. Once for no good reason, except we were freaked out and it was late at night.
Oh, and then she swallowed that marvel, adds Keiko casually, like she didn't nearly die of stress in the incident.
Who gives the baby a marble? Asks Pete,
which is what he says every time the subject comes up.
Your father, that's who?
Keiko says quickly.
His lucky marble, apparently. When it came out the other end, he asked for it back.
It's right then that Charlie clears his throat, and we all spin and realize that somehow he has entered this scrum from the dining room door without any of us noticing.
See what I was saying, Sophie? He says. These days, Keiko is all poop this, toilet that.
Keiko rolls her eyes and gives Charlie a quick hug.
Sorry if I offend a little brother-in-law, but you gotta understand, it's the gig. Once you've changed enough diapers, you forget what it was like not to change diapers.
Emily laughs, but I'm over it. Can we quit with the scatological talk in my kitchen, please? I say. I cut a glance to Charlie, trying to warn him with my eyes. Danger, danger, your new crush turns out to be a single mom. But he doesn't get it and tilts his head.
So everyone's met Emily, he says, smiling.
Then he crosses to her and says,
I saw your two very handsome young men on the way in.
And he kisses her. The scales fall from my eyes.
You knew they were coming?
He makes a face at me.
Only as of the last hour. You always make enough to choke a horse, so I figured, what's a couple extra enthusiastic diners?
I make some blustery noises like a dowager on Downton Abbey.
You could have called, I say.
And miss the look on your face right now, says Charlie.
Besides, I was afraid you'd freak. I open my mouth to freak, and then close it sharply.
I'm not freaking, I say. I'm unfreaked. I'm just going to grab a few more place settings, move around the table.
I hand Nettie to Pete like a sack of potatoes and walk Storm off into the dining room to escape the situation. But I've forgotten, the situation is in here, too. The little one, Justin slash Smush slash whatever, is spread out over my six top, kneeling on a dining chair and coloring dragons on oversized sheets of paper with a set of charcoals. His fingers, forehead, nose, shirt, and khaki pant legs are dusted black. His brother is slumped on the window bench with his feet up on another chair, reading a graphic novel. He's drinking a juice box, despite his advanced age. I look at them both, see they take no notice of me, and start rearranging the other tables, dragging a couple out of the way to make room for two side-by-side foretops. Neither boy gets up to help. I ask the older one if he wants me to do a kids' table or seat them with the rest of us. He looks at me, shrugging, and then back down again, like I've asked an unanswerable question.
It's not unanswerable.
What's unanswerable is why these kids are even here. Thanksgiving is supposed to be a six-top. The very six-top that is currently covered in charcoal fingerprints. It's supposed to be the three Dickinson siblings, Keiko and Annette, and whatever rando I drag up. The same thing, every year. Now everything is terribly different. Growing angrier, I pull over 8 chairs and my wooden high chair for Nettie. Then I feel my apron pocket for what has, of late, become something of a November talisman for me. It's a small stuffed turkey with a cardstock feather that reads Annette. It's still there. I had considered setting a place for her tonight, just as a nod to how much she has missed. But now that Emily is here with her 2 kids, I tuck it away in my pocket and rub my hands over the card gently. Annette, I whisper to myself, as though the letters are Braille. I miss you. I am just pouring out waters for the boys when there's a bustle of people coming through the kitchen door. Keiko says,
The oven timer went off while you were out here, so,
And she offers me the corn souffle wrapped in a towel, which has risen beautifully and will start to collapse in T-minus 3 seconds.
I tried to get everyone out here to see it, she says with a sheepish shrug.
Behind her is a small parade. Charlie with potatoes, Pete with Nettie, Dane with beans.
Sit, everyone, I insist. You're doing my job. Sit, sit.
They fall into their usual places, saying all the right things about how good the food looks, and I show Dane to his spot next to mine. The boys have followed their noses and are hovering at the end of the table. I put them at the spot farthest from Nettie, next to Dane and Charlie. And I'm just about to whoosh into the kitchen to get David, whip him onto a platter, and garnish him in a hurry, when Emily walks through the door, silicone mitts in her hands, and says,
Ta-da!
She is holding the turkey. My turkey. Still in the roasting pan, sloshing about in its own juices with no dignity. She hasn't even removed the tin foil that keeps his legs from overbrowning. Everyone says, Oh, which is the only polite thing to do, but this is not an ooh-worthy presentation. Has David even been out of the oven for more than a minute, I wonder? Or are we about to cut into an unrested, brined bird and let every drop of juicy goodness run out into a dented metal pan? Hurt, I want to take the bird out of her hands by force, shove my way back into the kitchen, plate the meat properly, and serve it to everyone at the table but her. Instead, I look at my family members, sitting there at their usual spots with the food I cooked crowding the table and the bottles of wine getting uncorked, and I realize I'm being an awful prig. I smile my best smile at Emily, make room for the roasting pan on the table near the center, and take my spot in front of it as she sets it down. Thank you, I manage to say to her. Huge help. Charlie locks my eyes and shrugs. He knows no one should touch my turkey. He knows his new girlfriend has done everything wrong from the moment she walked in the door. And still, after she's taken off my oven mitts, he pats the seat next to him, across from me, and gestures with his head for her to sit down. My heart gives a stutter. What else can he do? I ask myself. It's the only seat left at the table. The woman has to sit somewhere. The only trouble is, that seat is supposed to be Annette's.
Chapter 6. After dinner, I clear up the pans and plates on my own. Pete, bless his heart, has decided that tonight we will all try out a new Thanksgiving movie from the 90s called Dutch, starring that guy from Modern Family. Keiko is on the floor wrestling with Nettie, who has reached a tricky age of halting diaper changes but having no interest in the potty. Dane is regaling the remainder of the table with tales of the wilderness. It turns out the guy is quite the outdoorsman and has handled some serious mountains, rapids, and cycling adventures on his days off from... Okay, I have no idea what it is that he does. Jeremy, Emily's older son, responds to everything Dane says with one word. Sweet. While her younger one repeatedly asks him if there were bears there, and if not, were there any sharks? In and out of the dining room I go, arms full of this or that, dragging out the cleanup job for as long as humanly possible. There's hardly any of David left. Usually I send everyone home with foil cartons of turkey and rolls for sandwiches. I make up tin boxes of souffle and beans instead. The boys ate the meat and bread and potatoes like they'd never seen food before, but wouldn't abide the veg. Emily paid no mind, and I wondered what their regular diet must look like if they found innocent haricot vert with the gnocchi mushrooms and corn souffle so intimidating. Emily paid little mind to anything her boys did, actually, dominating the conversation for most of the meal. It was as though she hadn't spoken to another adult in years. Regarding Nettie's sleep schedule, an awkward lecture on how kids are all so different. They just do what they're going to do and there's no point fighting it. On Pete's new jerk associate, she once worked with a man like that, and it was what made her decide once and for all to go back to school and become a nurse. On my consideration of extending my profitable Sunday brunch menu to Saturdays as well,
Don't you just love brunch? Isn't it the most perfect meal?
I just love getting sweet brunch, French toast, pancakes, waffles, even crepes, and then savory on the side. Or have you ever served sweet rolls? Sometimes at brunch, I like to get a sweet roll with my coffee and then order something savory, like eggs with spinach and a hollandaise on an English muffin. What's that called? Eggs Florentine. I just love eggs Florentine, don't you? I know the whole meal ends up being 4,000 calories, but it's brunch. How can you not? Ideally, I won't finish the cleaning up until Emily, the brunching queen, has left. As we were finishing up dinner, she kept saying she needed to go home and get Smush off to bed. But then she kept talking and talking and talking. Finally, when there is nothing left to be done with dinner out there or in here, I decide I'll just do the dishes. I text Hugo and tell him he can sleep in tomorrow. And then realizing that he might have been counting on the hours, add that if he does want to come in, the bar's back mirror needs a good cleaning. Then I fire up the hottest water I can handle and start spraying dishes down one by one. Running my industrial dishwasher for such a small party is a waste of water and power. So I get everything soaking in the sink and start the work the old-fashioned way, enjoying the combination of water, keeping busy, and most importantly, solitude. Midway through the plates, Emily and her boys bustle through the kitchen, saying their goodbyes. Or rather, her goodbyes. I still haven't heard more than one syllable out of the teenager. And Smush seems more interested in a huge meat tenderizer he's found. Then Keiko comes in. Nettie, fast asleep on her shoulder, and kisses my cheek. "Good effort, Soph," she says. "And good food, as always. But we just can't rock anymore." "It's not even 9 p.m., I protest. "Exactly, 10 minutes till my bedtime," she says. "I'll be home just in time." 2 years ago, we all talked so late into the night that we had to put on planes, trains a second time, just to have an excuse to keep talking. Keiko, pregnant, fell asleep on her hard wooden chair and snored like a chainsaw, only to wake up, rally, and have two more pieces of pie. Now Nettie has her chubby hand wound through Keiko's hair, making it impossible for Keiko to completely straighten her head. Her diaper looks puffy with urine, and she's wearing pumpkin pie in her black baby-fine hair. I kiss a pumpkinless zone of head, tuck some wrapped-up leftovers in Keiko's diaper bag, and wish her a safe drive home. Next to leave is Dane. I haven't spoken more than a few words to him since dinner. Too upset about Emily to navigate this near stranger's feelings, too. And he's probably gotten the hint. Poor guy. When he comes through the swinging door, though, he is laughing. "Your brothers are killing me," he says. And then he comes over to the sink, and I see his face soften and start to worry he'll want to kiss me. "Dane," I start, but he interrupts. "Sorry, I can dry, but don't ask me to stay over," he says. "I'm due back at the station by midnight." I frown.
"The station?"
"Do you seriously not even know what I do for a living?" I pause and then sheepish shake my head. I don't, to be perfectly honest, know much of anything about him. "I'm a cop," he says. "Just made corporal, actually. I've tried to tell you that at least once on every date." I set down the pan I'm washing and look over at him. "Well," I say blandly, though I am truthfully a bit embarrassed. "Congratulations. You're a cop. I'm a chef."
I know you're a chef. I'm standing in your restaurant right now. I've met your family and come to your workplace and asked you out enough times to make my interest clear. But somehow I've missed all the ways you've made your own disinterest even clearer."
A wine glass I just picked up slips, forgotten, into the soapy water with a schloop. I try to figure out how to contest what Dane says, argue that I have done no such thing. But that's not the right thing to do, I realize. The right thing is to let him go. "I'm sorry," I say. "You're right. I just don't think we're a fit right now. But thank you for coming tonight, and sorry I didn't do better by you." And then, because it feels like the thing I might finally cry over, I turn on the dish sprayer and become terribly interested in a speck of gravy on the sterling tureen. When I look up again, Dane is gone. I go back to washing for real. Washing and ruminating. Not about Dane. I'm surprised he gave me what for tonight. But I utterly deserved it. And that's the end of that. Instead, I ruminate about my brother. When I was thinking that maybe Charlie should date again, this was not what I had in mind. Where Annette was put together, Emily's a mess. Where Annette was happy to be just the two of them, this woman has more baggage than a cargo hold. Where Annette was successful and smart, Emily seems like a broke ditz. The more I compare the two women, the angrier I get. Angrier at Charlie and Emily and even Annette for not being here to avert this situation in the first place. When I set down a plate on the counter so hard it cracks, I decide I need to take a moment. My kitchen opens to a small alley just 20 feet to the street, and when I walk out to the front, I see the lights of the Little Plum stealing out from the edges of my velveteen curtains. I see the street lights, the shops closed up and dimmed, the roads empty. It's just me out here. I hide for a few moments, taking in deep, crisp breaths of dry November air. In college, Annette and I had an embarrassing shared secret. We each smoked one cigarette a day. It was a habit she picked up at high school parties, a byproduct of being underparented by a heavy smoker, she always said. And me, well, I just wanted to be more like her, if I'm totally honest. We only did it when we were together, in our dorm room with the window open, at the end of a long day of coursework and flirting and drama, and eating Captain Crunch in our room dinner, so we didn't have to stop studying or binge-watching Friends, or both at the same time. I doubt that one cigarette a day was the worst thing a college student could do, but regardless, we resolved to quit the summer after senior year. I was off to culinary school, her to grad school for engineering. Cooks were famous for smoking like chimneys. Antoinette knew it was a slippery slope, too. It was time to grow up and start taking care of ourselves. We shared stories of mild cravings here and there, and occasionally, on rare benders, we'd buy a pack again at 2 in the morning, only to throw it out the very next day. Then, when she got engaged to Charlie, who would sooner eat worms than kiss a smoker, she told me all the cravings went away, and I decided mine had too, or would, starting right then. In their place, we vowed to make a whole new host of new traditions, traditions that showed how we were getting on with life. This meal, Thanksgiving dinner, was one of those new traditions. And now, I suppose, based on the way these last 2 years have gone, I have to accept that the tradition has died with her. No wonder I'm desperately craving a smoke. Annette, I say to the swirl of gray-blue night clouds. Girl, it's only 9:30 p.m., not 2 in the morning. Stop me from going to the gas station. What's so bad about the gas station? Says someone behind me. It's Charlie. He has pink in his cheeks I happen to know he only gets from red wine and pretty women. I guess he had a bit of both tonight. Emily, for all her faults, has a smile as bright as the moon. And a half-full wine glass is still in his hands. Charlie, stop eavesdropping, I tell him. He shakes his head. You can't eavesdrop on someone talking to herself on a street corner, he tells me. You can call the padded ambulance on them, but not eavesdrop. I wasn't talking to myself, I say. And I wasn't talking to you either. Are you craving a cigarette? I look at him in shock. How did you know? After a good whiskey on our second date, Annette confessed that you two liked a puff at the end of the day. She was always craving one after we had a big night out, or... He pauses a moment. When we were in Budapest, at the end. I smile sadly. We studied abroad together in Budapest our junior year. We would sit out on the window of our shitty third-story student apartment and marvel at our foreign adventures each night. That sneak, I say. She told me she never had cravings anymore. She wanted you to respect her. You always said she was supposed to be the grown-up between you. I sigh. I guess I did say that.
A lot to live up to.
Oh, please, we were best friends for 20 years. There was nothing she could do that would change how I saw her.
Still true? He asks.
I guess it must be. 2 glasses of wine over 4 hours and I'm out here talking to her and wishing we were having a smoke together.
Sounds like me every other night. Except instead of a cigarette, sub in a scoop of gelato.
We ate so much ice cream on our world tour. Almost every place in the world has some kind of icy cold dessert, you know.
Do you talk to her a lot?
I ask. I'm surprised by this. My brother isn't Mr. Gabfest. He and Annette had a way with communicative silence that sometimes unnerved me.
Constantly.
Too much, I think. It's only a worry if she answers back, I say. At least that's what I'm telling myself.
Charlie gives me a little laugh, puts his arm around me.
So, he says.
So what?
Oh, come on. You know you're dying to tell me.
My gut sinks as I realize exactly what he's talking about. I shake my head.
Charlie, no, don't ask me.
Ask you what?
I elbow him, albeit gently in the gut.
Don't ask me what I think of her, please. I'm a bit overwrought at the moment.
Dane dumped me because I didn't know he's a police officer.
I think that's Pete's fault. He might have let slip that he had never heard Dane's name come out of your mouth until today.
I shrug. It's hardly Pete's fault that I wasn't interested.
So why are you upset then? Asks Charlie.
If it's not about your flavor of the month. I look at him, irrationally angry.
Flavor of the season, thank you very much. And you know I don't date that much.
Charlie arches an eyebrow.
Oh, screw you. You can hardly talk. Yesterday, I was worried you were never going to get over Annette. The next day, I find out you've been sleeping with some hippy-dippy earth mother and playing stepdad to her kids.
I only just met her kids, he tells me,
his voice suddenly somber.
Tonight, same as you.
I narrow my eyes at him.
But you knew she had them, I presume.
He nods.
You didn't say anything on the phone.
I didn't want you to turn against her before you even met her.
I'm not against her, or her kids.
But, supplies Charlie, I saw the broken plate. You're against something.
The trouble with older brothers is that they've known you since you threw tantrums over jarred peach mash, so they recognize the signs of a humdinger coming on. And there it is, building up until I can't hold it in anymore. I want to stomp my feet and cross my arms. But instead, I just say it.
Okay, fine. You want to know what I'm so against? I'm against the idea of you dating someone so completely opposite from what you want in every single way. It's idiotic and selfish. One or both of your lives will get totally screwed up.
You don't necessarily know what I want, he tells me, perturbed.
I do. I say. I knew the love of your life very well. I knew what you guys had planned. And let me remind you, a screenager and something sticky named Smush weren't on the to-do list. Then there's the woman herself. Emily is...
I wave my hands in the air to indicate her big messy hair, her big messy life.
She's not Annette.
Charlie looks up at me.
No one is.
That's for damn sure, I say, caught up in myself.
So what then? I should be alone for the rest of my life? Does everyone get to keep living but me? He asks.
And I hear some of the first self-pity in his voice in all this time. It shakes me. Charlie has moped, and he has wept. And he has talked about Annette endlessly. So much that even her best friend wants him to get on with things. But this is the first time in 2 years I've heard him make it about himself. Somehow that makes me much sorrier that I can't get behind the idea of him with Emily, but I can't. I turn to him.
Charlie, I'm sorry, that's not what I meant.
No one wants you to be alone. It wasn't what Annette wanted either. You know as well as I do that she was thinking about who your next wife could be before she even entered hospice.
I'm just saying that a hot mess like Emily probably isn't what she had in mind.
Charlie sighs.
I take offense to that characterization. Emily's only a warm mess.
The same temperature of mess as I feel inside.
Despite myself, I give a little laugh.
Honestly, Soph, you don't know the half of it. Her ex is a complete turdball, a real hefty bag full of rats with rabies. He didn't want to split up, and is punishing him in every way he can for leaving him and taking the kids. That means he fought with her over Thanksgiving arrangements, and then when it was time to pick the kids up in the morning, he was nowhere to be found. And every month, he holds his child support until she agrees to meet him for a drink. Says he wants to see her get the check for himself. No, she's not giving it to some new boyfriend who's just using her for money. Every day with him, it's slimy stuff like that. And yet she keeps moving forward, one foot in front of the other.
Oh, Charlie, I wouldn't wish that on anyone, truly.
But do you really want to be a part of that?
I'm just getting started, he says. Justin, I mean, they call the poor kid Smush, so what can you expect? Hasn't made any progress in school, can't read a word or do 2+2, and is now repeating the first grade.
And Jeremy, well, I think he's a decent kid somewhere deep, deep down. But he's got a bad mix of bitterness from the divorce, his dad's manipulative streak, and being 14, it's a lot to deal with. Smush has never met a tree he won't climb and fall out of. And Jeremy's been called into the principal's, both for getting bullied and being a bully.
Yikes. Not to be harsh, but isn't this pretty much the exact reason you didn't want kids?
Pretty much. You know, Annette didn't have a great childhood. Weak mom, cruel dad. Probably not that different from this situation if Emily didn't fight so hard for the boys. And I always felt like I wasn't selfless enough to really enjoy parenting.
He sighs.
That and we just loved our life the way it was. We loved being able to skip town for a weekend whenever we wanted and spend summers wherever the wind blew us. It just suited us.
I nod. I know all this about my brother. I know it so, so well.
That's the thing. I think there will be other women who feel the same way you do. Maybe someone at the U or a teacher who gets enough kid time during her workday?
He shrugs. Maybe, but I'm not falling for one of those women.
I look at him. You're falling for Emily?
He nods. I think I am.
I exhale. I'm thinking, here we go. This is going to end badly.
Charlie shakes his head.
I've thought the same thing, believe me. Emily is strong inside and vulnerable on the outside. I'm the opposite. She's disorganized and impetuous. I'm used to everything being just so. Annette and I were living on 2 decent salaries and had nothing to spend it on but ourselves. Emily looks after 2 kids on a nursing assistant's salary, and she's up to her ears in debt from doing nursing school at night. We're very different, and yet,
I hate to say it, but when I look in Charlie's eyes, I recognize what I see there.
It's unmistakable. It's the first little glimmer of love.
And it's deeply troubling.
What would Annette say about this?
Charlie shakes his head.
I don't know. Thought about that constantly. Maybe she'd say, what the hell, just go for it.
I arch my eyebrow at him. Of all the sentences my best friend uttered in her 2 short life, what the hell, just go for it, was never one of them.
Charlie laughs.
Yeah, I know, she'd never say that. She'd say all the things you've been saying, that I should get out there for a bit, date around, try to find someone less messy, less complicated.
Someone to travel with and spend quiet nights reading with. Someone who can ski. I open my hands. The answer here is beyond clear to me.
But Charlie, being Charlie, seems to miss the entire point. He tilts his head and raises his glass up, as if he's toasting the heavens. Which I suppose he is.
Of course, the thing she said most often was that she just wanted me to have a happy life. And here's the funny thing.
Emily.
He tells me and the clouds and Annette, wherever she is now, at the same time.
Is making me very happy.
Part 3. Thanksgiving, 2020.
Hi, this is Sophie. I'm not listening. Go away. Hey, little sister, it's Pete. I miss you. Charlie misses you. Where have you been hiding? Or should I ask, with whom? Hi, this is Sophie. I'm not listening. Go away. Yeah, I'm leaving a message. I don't care what she says. Of course she listens. I bet she listens to every single one. Oh, hey, Sophie! It's your favorite sister-in-law in the whole world, Keiko, and Nettie wants to talk to you next, but she's playing a coding game because, yes, preschoolers code now, and let's face it, she'll be more employable than me by the time she's 10. But it won't matter because she will not leave her pants on. I put them on, she takes them off. I put them on again, I look away for 2 minutes, she's running through Target like Porky Pig. It's a nightmare. Are you thinking about having kids yet? You totally should. You'd love it. So much joy. Anyway, I'm calling because I know you aren't calling Charlie back. And Pete said, I won't get involved, this isn't my drama. And I said, Pete, you feckless wonder, you call one of them and sort this out. And then he said, can you do it? You're much more effective than I am. And damn it, he's right, so here we are. I want you to call Charlie. He loves you, and we love you. I assume you're upset with him about something, but whatever it is, it's probably stupid. Sorry, I don't mean that. It's just that we're weaning Jules right now, and I'm a ball of emotions. I'm weaning my last baby, Soph. No more sweet middle-of-the-night moments between mother and child. No more excuses to be antisocial. No more 500 extra calories a day. No more happy hormones. Sniff, sniff. I'm never going to be a mother again. This is the last time I'll ever be irreplaceable. After this, I'm just some lady nagging them about cleaning their rooms and getting straight A's. And what if Nettie never gets into college? She's having a terrible time with scissors. And isn't that the first sign? I mean, Sophie, what is it all for? I ruin my body, set my career back by years, go gray, get saggy boobs, and they're only going to leave me in the... Oh, crap, the baby's crying, and I can't keep a single thought in my head. Why did I call? Oh, right, call Charlie. Work this nonsense out. Don't make me come over there. Hi, this is Sophie. I'm not listening. Go away.
It's me again. Your brother. Charlie, I know why you aren't returning my calls. You don't want to say no, but you also refuse to say yes, so you're going to pretend you didn't even hear the question. You're not that sneaky, little sister. This is the same technique you used when you went to the mall and got your belly button pierced against Mom's direct order, and it bled through your shirt on the second day. Once again, you're not fooling anyone. You are kind of being a brat, though, and Pete used a different B word, just so you know. I'm the nicer brother, in case that wasn't clear by now. And I'm asking this one tiny, minuscule little favor of you. We are asking this one favor, all four of us. I know it's hard to change things up. You've made it clear it's not what you think is best. Believe me, I am filled with doubt at every turn. But this is what Emily wants. And it's my responsibility to try to make her happy. I just want to be a good partner. So even if you won't do it for her, can't you consider doing it for me? You know we could use a little bit of mercy after the summer we've had. If I never see the inside of family court again, it'll be too soon. Okay, I better go before the message gets too long. Please, just think about it. Love you.
Hi, this is Sophie. I'm not listening. Go away.
Charlie again. Listen, I know in my last message I told you to think about it, but I have to take that back and say it's time to just decide one way or another. I've been calling you for a month to talk about this, and you haven't called me back, and now here we are. Morning of. The way I see it, the turkey, rich, I guess, goes into the oven in like 15 minutes. So just, I don't know, let me know. If it's a yes, we'll see you here at 5. If it's a no, well then, I guess this is Happy Thanksgiving. Love you. Sorry it's come to this.
Chapter 7. 2 years have gone by since Charlie introduced us to Emily. 2 years for my brother to come to his senses, wrap up his rebound, and move on. 2 years for life to go back to the way it was before Emily. Or 2 years for him to become an essential part of two boys' lives, to start writing huge checks that are supposedly for nursing school, to give up his love of travel, freedom, and adventure to stay home with Smush every night while Emily is gone, and to start a 529 plan for Jeremy. And on my end, 2 years of me waking up once a week in the middle of the night, worried about when, not if, this strange situation is going to fall apart, and what will be left of my brother when it does. But by now, I'm kind of hoping they'll just get on with it and break up so we can get to the part where we pick up the pieces. I'm not a monster, and only a monster could keep herself from being a little charmed by Emily's boys over time. Jeremy is a confused kid, sometimes furious with Charlie over the slightest bit of discipline, sometimes letting a smile sneak out when he sees my brother in the stands of his basketball games. It's so endearing that I've even been thinking about bringing him on at the restaurant, so he can earn some money for that car he's dreaming of. And so he can see what a life washing dishes is like, should he keep slacking off in school and getting in trouble with the police. Smush, in the meantime, has let himself fall in love with Charlie as a de facto stepdad, and that's more concerning than any other aspect of this situation. Even as Charlie and Emily bicker over the details of child rearing, money, how much the dumpster fire X should be let into their lives, and why it's actually important to clean bathrooms once in a while, open-hearted Smush can find no fault in his new hero. His second grade, What I Did This Summer project, was just drawings of him and Charlie installing a zipline in their backyard, going go-karting, making homemade ice cream with a crank machine, and that camping trip when they had to come back a day early because Smush tried to pick up a skunk. Nowhere in there did Smush mention the hours both boys spent in family court with their child advocates, while the man Emily was stupid enough to marry was suing her for half-time placement to avoid paying stacks upon stacks of child support. Nor did Smush note the dark circles under my brother's eyes, as the stress of sudden-onset parenting, being the sole wage earner now that Emily's switched to full-time school, and dealing with endless strings of lawyers and mediators started to wear him down. This past summer has been rough. Everyone has had to pitch in. Pete and Keiko have helped pay for a counselor for Jeremy. I've spent hours taking Smush to parks and playgrounds so Emily can deal with the perverse legal quagmire that is a deadbeat dad's parental rights. And Charlie? Well, there's just nothing he wouldn't give for that woman. And sometimes it feels like there's nothing of him she won't take. Rich, the turkey, like Rich the man, is oversized. Last year's Thanksgiving was a half-hearted affair. Keiko was just 3 months postpartum, and Nettie was a terror, feeling usurped and jealous. Emily's boys spent it with their paternal grandmother, and my date was a complete stranger who had looked about 10 years younger in his profile photos. He was fine, if an overly loud breather, and he brought a gorgeous salted caramel pie from my favorite bakery. But we all ate it in silence, about 3 minutes after the dinner dishes were cleared, and then rushed Keiko and Pete home to get a few hours of sleep before the baby started her hourly feed and nap cycle. Emily, tired from nursing school, fell asleep mid-sentence while Charlie was bringing out coffee. As she slept, I tried to bring myself to have the talk with Charlie. This isn't the life you wanted. She's sucking the energy out of you. This isn't the road back to happiness, and so on and so forth. But I couldn't do it. It was still too soon after Annette. He was still too fragile. Maybe if I just gave them some more time.
In the end, I said nothing. And the whole event was done by 7:15. Rich and I went out, had one more drink, kissed goodbye, and then performed what can only be described as mutual ghosting. I went home and ate the rest of the pie by myself. Today, by contrast, I am meant to be feeding the largest crowd in our little tradition's history. Charlie, Emily, and her two boys, and Pete, Keiko, Nettie, and baby Jules. Plus Damien, a little plum server I'm crazy about who just broke up with his boyfriend and needs as many shoulders to cry on as possible. He's been falling to pieces every time a proposal happens in his section. It's bad form to bring out the complimentary champagne, raise one's glass, loudly make a toast, and then burst into tears and shut oneself in the walk-in cooler. Meanwhile, if I don't take action soon, as I knew full well even before Charlie's voicemail ultimatum, tonight's dinner will be much, much smaller than I originally anticipated. Emily, enabled by my disloyal brother, has decided she wants to have Thanksgiving at their house this year. And by their house, I mean the house my brother moved into after he left my parents' place. The house he now pays the mortgage for, so Emily can go to school full time. The house he has done endless repairs on, has painted top to bottom, has zero equity in, and could be kicked out of at any time. That house. I pull Rich out of his brining tub with more than a touch of fury. Normally, I would lovingly rinse the bird, pat him dry like a newborn fresh from a bath, and gently slide a compound herb butter under every inch of his skin. Today, if I had a fire hose, I would shoot it at him. What's the point of laboring over a perfect poultry masterpiece? I hope he's oversalted and gummy-skinned. I hope when Emily takes a bite of him, her mouth is full of stringy, overcooked white meat that gets stuck in her teeth. I hope I forget a bay leaf in her stuffing. I hope someone absentmindedly tops up her white wine with Cabernet. I give a heavy sigh. There can be no doubt. The Dickinson family Thanksgiving tradition is a lost cause. Rich is going to go into my oven and fill my kitchen with wonderful smells, and then he is going to get tented with foil and hauled in my passenger seat to Emily's little bungalow 8 blocks away. No little plum. No champagne toasts and hugs in the kitchen. No 3 kinds of potatoes. No after-dinner 80s movies on VHS. As far as I know, Emily doesn't even own a VCR. Pete and Keiko, arguing that I have gotten to host for a decade now, have resigned themselves to their fate, asking only that Charlie do some child-proofing to the house before their very active children arrive. Last time Keiko brought them there for a visit, Nettie nearly pulled Charlie's ugly man recliner backward on top of herself, and Jules spent the entire time on a desperate mission to eat Legos. That means I have a choice to make: eat a 20-pound turkey with my heartbroken server, or give in and dine a la dysfunction. Knowing I bought Rich from a family farm months ago, Charlie, in one of his many, many Thanksgiving petitions, suggested I bring the turkey and stuffing and let him and Emily take care of the rest. I can only imagine what the rest will entail. In all the years I have known my brother, he has never baked a dessert in his life. But he is supposed to be in charge of something sweet and pumpkin-y this year. And Emily, who feeds her sons for the week by making 4 boxes of macaroni and cheese on Sunday and stirring in a bag of frozen broccoli, will surely stun us all with her culinary creations. I'm being sarcastic, in case my bitterness is too subtle. What if I just didn't go? I let myself wonder for a moment. What if I donated Rich to the food pantry and took Damien to the downtown hotel for dinner? They always do a decent prime rib on holidays. I had to resort to that last Easter when my flight to Arizona was canceled at the last minute. Pete was at Keiko's family's house, and since Emily's kids were at her ex's, she and Charlie went to the lake for a romantic getaway. I brought a book to the hotel, sat at a window two-top, and got a wonderful creamed spinach on the side. I didn't feel lonely that day, though there were families in their Easter best filling the rest of the room. I was philosophical. After all, if I could have had anyone there to talk to, it would have been Annette, and she was not available. After my best friend, my second favorite form of company was my own. If I did stick to my guns and bail this year, Damien and I could drink too much and complain about the stupid things love makes you do. We could order more creamed spinach and try the sweet potato pie. Heedless of calories and diverse in tastes, he is excellent dinner company, when not reduced to tears. In fact, I would say we're becoming real friends. He may be the first person I've even wanted to be friends with since Annette died. He's kind and strong-willed and likes to eat almost as much as I do. And he has big dreams of wine stewarding, which I have been stoking, even though I know it will lead to him leaving the Little Plum and her minimalist cellar. At the thought of this, I look at my watch. It's 11 a.m. I'm doing the turkey low and slow this year, followed by a quick crisp-up, but whatever, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. Yesterday, my bartender opened a new bottle of our best champagne and ended up selling just one pour of it. That means it's practically my duty as an owner to keep it from going flat over the holiday. And I will not take that duty lightly. I find the bottle behind the bar, pour a half flute, down it in 2 angry swigs, burp, and then pour a second. Rich and I can take an Uber. Besides, if I can't have my real Thanksgiving, why worry about what state I'm in when I arrive to the fake one? Maybe with a few glasses of liquid courage, I'll be able to finally take Charlie aside and tell him that even 2 years later, I'm as skeptical of Emily as I was the first time I met her. Tell him that she's taking advantage of his kindness, letting him fix up her house, give her money, take care of her kids, and has nothing to offer in return but a never-ending run-on sentence. And then I'll remind him about the love of his life, the woman he seemed to forget in an instant, my best friend. How happy we all were. How many dreams he's left behind. My phone buzzes on the countertop farthest from me. If it's a voicemail, it buzzes twice, but it's just once this time. I go wake up the phone with my elbow and look at the screen.